our emotional regulation depends as much or more on the stability and predictability of the social environment, on the maintenance of our cultures, as on interior processes classically related to the strength of the ego or the personality. Social order is a necessary precondition for psychological stability. It is primarily our companions and their actions or inactions that stabilize or destabilize our emotions. A rat, a person, is a complacent creature in explored territory. When in unexplored territory, however, it is anything but calm. A rat moved from its home cage to a new and unknown environment, a new cage, for example, will first freeze, even though it has never been punished in a new situation. If nothing terrible happens to it, nothing punishing, threatening, or additionally unpredictable, it will begin to sniff, to look around, to move its head, to gather new information about the intrinsically frightening place it now inhabits. Gradually, it starts to move about. It will explore the whole cage with increasing confidence. It is mapping the new environment for affective valence. It wants to find out, is there anything here that will kill me? Anything here I can eat? Anyone else here? Someone hostile or friendly? A potential mate? The rat is interested in determining whether the new place contains anything of determinate interest to a rat, and it explores to the best of its capacity to make that judgment. It is not primarily interested in the objective nature of the new circumstances. A rat cannot actually determine what is objective and what is merely personal opinion, nor does it care. It just wants to know what it should do. What happens if an animal encounters something truly unexpected, something that should just not be according to its current frame of reference or system of belief? The answer to this question sheds substantial light on the nature of the orienting reflex in its full manifestation. Modern experimental psychologists have begun to examine the response of animals to natural sources of mystery and threat. They allow the animals to set up their own environments, realistic environments, and then expose them to the kinds of surprising circumstances they might encounter in real life. The appearance of a predator in previously safe space, space previously explored, that is, and mapped as useful or irrelevant, constitutes one type of realistic surprise. Blanchard and colleagues described the naturalistic behavior of rats under such conditions. When a cat is presented to established mixed-sex groups of laboratory rats living in a visible burrow system, the behaviors of the subjects change dramatically, in many cases, for 24 hours or more. The initial active defensive behavior, flight to the tunnel chamber system, is followed by a period of immobility, during which the rats make 22 kilohertz ultrasonic vocalizations, which apparently serve as alarm cries at a high rate. As freezing breaks up, proximic avoidance of the open area gradually gives way to a pattern of risk assessment of the area where the cat was encountered. Subjects poke their heads out of the tunnel openings to scan the open area where the cat was presented for minutes or hours before emerging. And when they do emerge, their locomotory patterns are characterized by behaviors that theoretically reduce their visibility and vulnerability to predators, and by very short corner runs into and out of the open area. These risk assessment activities appear to involve active gathering of information about the possible danger source, providing a basis for a gradual return to non-defensive behaviors. Active risk assessment is not seen during early post-cat exposure, when freezing and avoidance of the open area are the dominant behaviors, but rises to a peak about 7 to 10 hours later, and then gradually declines. Non-defensive behaviors, such as eating, drinking, and sexual and aggressive activity, tend to be reduced over the same period. The unexpected appearance of a predator, where nothing but defined territory previously existed, terrifies the rats, badly enough that they scream about it persistently for a long period of time. Once this initial terror abates, which occurs only if nothing else horrible or punishing happens, curiosity is disinhibited and the rats return to the scene of the crime. The space renovelized by the fact of the cat has to be transformed once again into explored territory as a consequence of active modification of behavior and representational schema, not by passive desensitization to the unexpected. The rats run across the territory contaminated by the presence of the cat to find out if anything dangerous to running rats still lurks there. If the answer is no, then the space is defined once again as home territory, which is that place where commonplace behaviors produce desired ends. The rats transform the dangerous unknown into familiar territory as a consequence of voluntary exploration. In the absence of such exploration, terror reigns unchecked. It is just as illuminating to consider the responses of rats to their kin, who constitute explored territory, in contrast to their attitude towards strangers, whose behavior is not predictable. Rats are highly social animals, perfectly capable of living with their familiar compatriots in peace. They do not like members of other kin groups, however. They will hunt them down and kill them. Accidental or purposeful intruders are dealt with in the same manner. Rats identify one another by smell. If an experimenter removes a well-loved rat from its familial surroundings, scrubs it down, provides it with a new odor, and returns it to its peers, it will be promptly dispatched by those who once loved it. The new rat constitutes unexplored territory. His presence is regarded as a threat, not unreasonably, to everything currently secure. Chimpanzees, perfectly capable of killing foreign devils, even those who were once familiar, act in much the same manner. Explored territory, phenomenology, and neuropsychology. When we explore, we transform the indeterminate status and meaning of the unknown thing that we are exploring into something determinate. In the worst case, rendering it non-threatening, non-punishing. In the best, manipulating and/or categorizing it so that it is useful. Animals perform this transformation in the course of actual action, which is to say that they construct their worlds by shifting their positions and changing their actions in the face of the unknown, and by mapping the consequences of those shifts and changes in terms of their affective or motivational valence. When an animal encounters an unexpected situation, such as a new object placed in its cage, it first freezes, watching the object. If nothing terrible happens while it is immobile, it moves, slowly and at a distance, monitoring the thing for its reactions to these cautious exploratory activities. Perhaps the animal sniffs at the thing or scratches at it, trying to determine what it might be good or bad for. It maps the utility and valence of the object, conceived in relationship to its ongoing activity, and perhaps to possible patterns of activity in the future. The animal builds its world of significances from the information generated in the course of, as a consequence of, ongoing exploratory behavior. The application of experimental search programs, drawn primarily from the reservoir of learned, imitated, and instinctual behavior, or manifested as trial and error, involves behavioral alteration, exploration, play, and subsequent transformation of sensory and affective input. When an animal actively explores something new, It changes the sensory quality and motivational significance of that aspect of its experience as a consequence of its exploratory strategy. This means that the animal exhibits a variety of behaviors in a given mysterious situation and monitors the results. It is the organized interpretation of these results and the behaviors that produce them that constitute the world, past, present, and future of the animal, in conjunction with the unknown, of course, which constantly supersedes the capacity for representation. It is not too much to say that the animal elicits the properties of the object, sensory and affective, or even brings them into being through its capacity for creative investigation. Animals that are relatively simple, compared, say, to higher-order primates, including man, are limited in the behaviors they manifest by the structure of their physiology. A rat cannot pick anything up, for example, to examine it in detail, and does not, in addition, have the visual capacity to focus intensely on the kinds of tiny features we can perceive. Higher-order non-human primates have a more developed grip, however, which enables more detailed exploration, and, in addition, have a relatively sophisticated prefrontal cortex. This means that such primates can evoke more features from the world directly, and that they are increasingly capable of modeling and acting. The prefrontal cortex is the newest part of the motor unit, and grew out of the direct motor control centers in the course of cortical evolution. More sophistication in development of the prefrontal centers means, in part, heightened capacity for abstract exploration, which means investigation in the absence of actual movement, which means the capacity to learn from the observation of others and through consideration of potential actions before they emerge in behavior. This means increasing capability for thought, considered as abstracted action and representation. Action and thought produce phenomena. Novel acts and thoughts necessarily produce new phenomena. Creative exploration, concrete and abstract, is therefore linked in a direct sense to being. Increased capacity for exploration means existence in a qualitatively different, even new, world. This entire argument implies, of course, that more complex and behaviorally flexible animals inhabit, construct, if you will, a more complex universe. Humans possess cortical development, prefrontal and otherwise, that is unique in its great mass and, more importantly, in its structure. Various indices of development have been used to signify the nature of the relationship between the brain and intelligence. Sheer mass is one measure. Degree of surface convolution, another. The former measure is contaminated by size of animal. Larger animals tend to have more absolutely massive brains. This does not necessarily make them smarter. Brain mass, corrected for body size, constitutes the encephalization quotient, a common rough measure of animal intelligence. Degree of surface convolution constitutes an additionally useful measure. The gray matter of the brain, which theoretically does much of the work associated with intelligence, occupies the brain's surface, which has been dramatically increased in area by folding. Some representatives of the cetacean family, dolphins and whales, have encephalization quotients similar to and brain surfaces more convoluted than man's, although the thickness of the cetacean neocortex is about half that of the human. Consideration of this high level of nervous development has led to speculation about the potential superhuman range of cetacean ability. However, it is structure and organization of cortex, not simply mass, or even relative mass or surface area, that most clearly defines the nature and reach of a species' experience and competence. More particularly, it is embodiment of the brain that matters. Brain structure necessarily reflects embodiment, despite the archaic presumption of the independence of spirit and matter, or soul and body, or mind and body, because the body is, in a primary sense, the environment to which the brain has adapted. The body is specifically represented in the neocortex. This representation is often given schematic form as the homunculus, or little man. The homunculus was discovered by Wilder Penfield, who mapped the surface of the cortices of his neurosurgical patients by stimulating them electrically, painstakingly, point after point. He did this to find out what different sections of the brain were doing, so that he could do the least damage possible when attempting to surgically treat epilepsy or cancer or other forms of brain abnormality. He would probe the surface of the brain of one of his awake patients with an electrode. Patients undergoing neurosurgery are frequently awake as the brain feels no pain, and monitor the results either directly or by asking the patient what he or she experienced. Sometimes such stimulation would produce visions, sometimes elicit memories, other times it produced movements or sensations. Penfield determined in this manner how the body was mapped onto the central nervous system, how it was incarnated, so to speak, in intrapsychic representation. He established, for example, that homunculi come in two forms, motor and sensory, the former associated with the primary zone of the motor unit, the latter associated with the primary zone of the sensory unit. The motor form, represented schematically in Figure 10, the motor homunculus, is of most interest to us because our discussion centers on motor output. The motor homunculus is a very odd little creature. Its face, particularly mouth and tongue, and hands, particularly thumbs, are grossly disproportionate to the rest of its body. This is because comparatively large areas of the motor cortex are given over to control of the face and hands, which are capable of an immense number of complex and sophisticated operations. The motor homunculus is an interesting figure. It might be regarded as the body, insofar as the body has anything to do with the brain. It is useful to consider the structure of the homunculus because it is, in some profound way, representative of our essential nature, as it finds expression in emotion and behavior. The most outstanding characteristic of the motor homunculus, for example, the hand with its opposable thumb, is the defining feature of the human being. The ability to manipulate and explore characteristics of objects, large and small, restricted as a general capacity to the highest primates, sets the stage for elicitation of an increased range of their properties for their utilization as tools. For more comprehensive transformation of their infinite potential into definable actuality. The hand, used additionally to duplicate the action and function of objects, also allows first for imitation and pointing, and then for full-blown linguistic representation. Used for written language, the hand additionally enables long-distance, temporal and spatial, transfer of its ability to another, and for the elaboration and extension of exploration during the process of writing, which is hand-mediated thinking. Even development of spoken language, the ultimate analytic motor skill, might reasonably be considered an abstract extension of the human ability to take things apart and reassemble them in an original manner. Interplay between hand and brain has literally enabled the individual to change the structure of the world. Consideration of the structure and function of the brain must take this primary fact into account. A dolphin or whale has a large, complex brain, a highly developed nervous system, but it cannot shape its world. It is trapped, so to speak, in its streamlined, test-tube-like form, specialized for oceanic life. It cannot directly alter the shape of its material environment in any complex manner. Its brain, therefore, is not likely prepared to perform any traditionally creative function. Indeed, as one would suspect, lacks the sophisticated structuring characteristic of primate brains. It is not just the hand, however, that makes the crucial human difference, although it is the most obvious, and perhaps the most important, single factor. It is more a style or melody of adaptation that characterizes the individual human being. This style is adaptation for exploration of the unknown within a social context. This adaptation is capacity for speech-mediated creation, elaboration, remembrance, description, and subsequent communication of new behavior patterns, and for representation of the frequently novel consequences of those patterns. The hand itself was rendered more useful by the development of vertical stance, which extended visual range and freed the upper body from the demands of locomotion. The fine musculature of the face, lips, and tongue, overrepresented once again in the motor homunculus, helped render subtle communication possible. Development of explicit language extended the power of such communication immensely. Increasingly detailed exchange of information enabled the resources of all to become the resources of each, and vice versa. That process of feedback greatly extended the reach and utility of the hand, providing every hand with the ability, at least in potential, of every other hand, extant currently or previously. Evolution of the restricted central field of the eye, which has input expanded 10,000 times in the primary visual area, and is additionally represented interhemispherically at several higher-order cortical sites, was of vital importance to development of visual language and enabled close observation, which made gathering of detailed information simpler. Combination of hand and eye enabled Homo sapiens to manipulate things in ways qualitatively different from those of any other animal. The individual can discover what things are like under various voluntarily produced or accidentally encountered, yet considered, conditions. Upside down, flying through the air, hit against other things, broken into pieces, heated in fire, and so on. The combination of hand and eye allowed human beings to experience and analyze the emergent nature of things. This ability, revolutionary as it was dramatically extended by application of hand-mediated, spoken, and written language. The human style of adaptation extends from the evidently physical to the more subtly psychological as well. The phenomenon of consciousness, for example, arguably the defining feature of man, appears related in some unknown fashion to breadth of cellular activation in the neocortex. Bodily features with large areas of cortical representation are also therefore more thoroughly represented in consciousness, at least in potential. This can be made immediately evident to subjective awareness merely by contrasting the capacity for control and monitoring of the hand, for example, with the much less represented expanse of the back. Consciousness also evidently expands or sharpens during the course of activities designed to enhance or increase adaptive competence, during the course of creative exploration. Processing of novel or otherwise interesting sensory information, associated with the orienting complex, heightened awareness, and focused concentration, activates large areas of neocortex. Similarly, increased cortical mobilization takes place during the practice phase of skill acquisition, when awareness appears required for development of control. The area of such engagement or mobilization shrinks in size as movement becomes habitual and unconscious, or when sensory information loses interest or novelty. Finally, as we have noted before, intrinsic pleasure of an intense nature appears to accompany activation of the cortical systems during psychomotor exploratory activity undertaken in the face of the unknown. The operation of these systems appears mediated in part by the neurotransmitter dopamine, involved in producing subjective and behavioral response to cues of reward in the form of hope, curiosity, and active approach. Human beings enjoy capacity for investigation, classification, and consequent communication, which is qualitatively different from that characterizing any other animal. The material structure of Homo sapiens is ideal for exploration and for the dissemination of the results thereof. Spiritually, psychologically, man is characterized by the innate capacity to take true pleasure in such activity. Our physical attributes, the abilities of the hand, in combination with the other physiological specializations of man, define who we are and enable us to endlessly elicit new properties from previously stable and predictable elements of experience. The object, any object, serves us as a source of limitless possibility, or at least possibility limited only by the capacity for exploratory genius exhibited at any particular moment. Simple animals perform simple operations and inhabit a world whose properties are equally constrained, a world where most information remains latent. Human beings can manipulate, take apart, and put together with far more facility than any other creature. Furthermore, our capacity for communication, both verbal and nonverbal, has meant almost unbelievable facilitation of exploration and subsequent diversity of adaptation. Thinking might, in many cases, be regarded as the abstracted form of exploration, as the capacity to investigate without the necessity of direct motoric action. Abstract analysis, verbal and nonverbal, of the unexpected or novel plays a much greater role for humans than for animals, a role that generally takes primacy over action. It is only when this capacity fails partially or completely in humans, or when it plays a paradoxical role, amplifying the significance or potential danger of the unknown through definitive but false negative labeling, that active exploration or active avoidance, with its limitations and dangers, becomes necessary. Replacement of potentially dangerous exploratory action with increasingly flexible and abstracted thought means the possibility for growth of knowledge without direct exposure to danger, and constitutes one major advantage of the development of intelligence. The abstract intelligence characteristic of the human being developed in parallel with rapid evolution of the brain. We can communicate the results and interpretations of our manipulations, and the nature of the procedures that constitute that manipulation, to each other across immense spatial and temporal barriers. This capacity for exploration, verbal elaboration, and communication of such, in turn, dramatically heightens our capacity for exploration, as we have access to all communicated strategies and interpretive schemas accumulated over time, generated in the course of the creative activity of others. In normal parlance, this would mean merely that we have been able to discover more aspects of the world. It seems to me more accurate, however, to recognize the limitations of this perspective and to make room for the realization that new procedures and modes of interpretation literally produce new phenomena. The word enables differentiated thought and dramatically heightens the capacity for exploratory maneuvering. The world of human experience is constantly transformed and renewed as a consequence of such exploration. In this manner, the word constantly engenders new creation. The capacity to create novel behaviors and categories of interpretation in response to the emergence of the unknown might be regarded as the primary hallmark of human consciousness, indeed, of human being. Our engagement in this process literally allows us to carve the world out of the undifferentiated mass of unobserved and unencountered existence, a form of existence that exists only hypothetically as a necessary fiction, a form about which nothing can be experienced unless accurately stated. We carve out the world as a consequence of our direct interactions with the unknown, most notably with our hands, which enable us to manipulate things, to change their sensory aspects, and, most importantly, to change their importance to us, to give them new, more desirable value. The capacity for dexterous manipulation is particularly human and has enabled us to radically alter the nature of our experience. Equally particular, however, is our capacity for abstract exploration, which is thought about action and its consequences, in the absence of action and its consequences. The manner in which we conduct our abstracted exploration appears as tightly linked to the physiological structures of our brains as the manner in which we move while exploring. In novel circumstances, our behavioral output is mediated by the systems that govern fear and appropriate inhibition and hope and appropriate activation. The same things happen when we think abstractly, even when we think about how others think. Animal exploration is primarily motor in nature. An animal must move around an unfamiliar thing or situation to determine its affective relevance and sensory nature. This process of moving around experimentally appears as a consequence of the interaction between the mutually regulatory or inhibitory evaluative systems whose responsibilities are identification of potential danger or threat and potential satisfaction or promise. In the human case, each of these systems apparently comes, in the course of normal development, to dominate one of our twinned cortical hemispheres. The right governs response to threat and to punishment, while the left controls response to promise and, perhaps, although much less clearly, to satisfaction. This basically means that the right hemisphere governs our initial responses to the unknown, while the left is more suited for actions undertaken while we know what we are doing. This is in part because everything thoroughly explored has in fact been rendered either promising or satisfying, or at least irrelevant. If threat or punishment still lurks somewhere, that is, somewhere we must be, our behavioral adaptation is, by definition, insufficient, and the unexpected has not been vanquished. We have been unable to modify our actions to elicit from the environment, really, from the unknown, those consequences we wish to produce. Richard Davidson and his colleagues have been investigating the relationship between different patterns of cortical electrical activity and mood states in adults and children. Davidson et al. Have concluded that the twin hemispheres of the human brain are differentially specialized for affect, at least with regard to their frontal regions. Signs of positive affect, like genuine smiling in infants, are accompanied by heightened comparative activation of the left frontal cortex. Negative states of affect, like those occurring in chronic depression, by contrast, are accompanied by heightened activation of the right frontal hemisphere. Substantial additional evidence exists to support this general claim. To put it most fundamentally, it appears that the twin hemispheres of the brain are differentially specialized. One, for operation in unexplored territory, where the nature and valence of things remains indeterminate, and two, for operation in explored territory, where things have been rendered either irrelevant or positive as a consequence of previous exploration. Our brains contain two emotional systems, so to speak. One functions when we do not know what to do, and initiates the exploratory process that creates secure territory. The other functions when we are in fact secure. The fact of the presence of these two subsystems, but not their locale, has been known for a good while. Norman Meyer and T.C. Schnirla hypothesized many decades ago that mechanisms of withdrawal and approach, characteristic of animals at virtually all levels of the evolutionary scale, provided the foundation for motivation as such. The nature of these two systems can best be understood by relating emotional state to motor activity, as we have done previously. Each hemisphere, right and left, appears to have what might be described as a family of related functions, portrayed in Figure 11, the twin cerebral hemispheres and their functions. The right hemisphere, less language fluent than its generally more dominant twin, appears specialized for the inhibition and extinction of behavior, and, therefore, for the production of negative emotion, for generation and manipulation of complex visual and auditory images, for coordination of gross motor actions, and for rapid and global recognition of patterns. The right hemisphere appears to come online when a particular situation is rife with uncertainty, appears particularly good at governing behavior when what is and what to do have not yet been clearly specified. It might be posited, in consequence, that this hemisphere is still under limbic control, since the limbic system is responsible for detecting novelty and initiating exploratory behavior. This archaic control mechanism would then drive the processes of imagistic hypothesis generation that constitute the processes of abstract exploration, fantasy, we use to give determinate and oft bizarre form to the unknown. The left hemisphere, by contrast, appears particularly skilled at linguistic processing and communication, at detailed linear thinking, at fine motor skill, and at the comprehension of wholes in terms of their constituent elements. The left hemisphere, particularly its frontal or motor subunit, also governs approach behavior in the presence of cues of satisfaction, is integrally involved in the production of positive affect, and appears particularly good at carrying out practiced activities, applying familiar modes of apprehension. The left seems at its best when what is and what should be done are no longer questions, when tradition governs behavior and the nature and meaning of things has been relatively fixed. The dual specialization of the left, for what is being practiced and for what is positive, can be understood in part in the following manner. Positive affect rules in known territory, by definition. A thing or situation has been explored most optimally, and is therefore most well known, if it has been transformed by behavioral adaptations manifested in its presence into something of determinate use or satisfaction, or into potential for such, into promise. The right hemisphere, in contrast to the left, appears to have remained in direct contact with and to be specialized for encounter with the unknown and its terrors, which are apperceived in the domain of instinct, motivation, and affect long before they can be classified or comprehended intellectually. The right hemisphere's capacity for inhibition and extinction of behavior, for inducing caution during exploration, for governing flight, for producing negative affect, ensures that due respect is granted the inexplicable and therefore dangerous when it makes its appearance. The right's aptitude for global pattern recognition, which appears as a consequence of its basic neurophysiological structure, helps ensure that a provisional notion, a fantastic representation of the unknown event, what it is like, how action should be conducted in its presence, what other things or situations it brings to mind, might be rapidly formulated. The right hemisphere appears integrally involved in the initial stages of analysis of the unexpected or novel, and its a priori hypothesis is always this. This unknown place, this unfamiliar space, this unexplored territory is dangerous, and therefore partakes in the properties of all other known dangerous places and territories, and all those that remain unknown as well. This form of information processing, A is B, is metaphor. Generation of metaphor, key to the construction of narratives, dreams, dramas, stories, and myth, might well be regarded as the first stage of hypothesis construction. As situation-specific adaptive behaviors are generated as a consequence of exploration, this provisional labeling or hypothesis, or fantasy, might well undergo modification, assuming nothing actually punishing or determinately threatening occurs. Such modification constitutes further and more detailed learning. Anxiety recedes in the absence of punishment or further threat, including novelty. Hope occupies the affective forefront, accompanied by the desire to move forward and to explore, under the governance of the left hemisphere. The right hemisphere appears capable of dealing with less determinate information. It can use forms of cognition that are more diffuse, more global, and more encompassing to come to terms initially with what cannot yet be understood but undeniably exists. The right hemisphere uses its capacity for massive generalization and comprehension of imagery to place the novel stimulus in an initially meaningful context, which is the a priori manner of appropriate categorization. This context is defined by the motivational significance of the novel thing, which is revealed first by the mere fact of novelty, which makes it both threatening and promising, and then in the course of its detailed exploration. The right hemisphere remains concerned with the question, what is this new thing like? Meaning, what should be done in the presence of this unexpected occurrence, and does not care what is this thing objectively. What is the new thing like means, is it dangerous or threatening, first and foremost, satisfying or promising? Categorization, according to Valence, means that the thing is what it signifies for behavior. The chaos that constitutes the unknown is rendered predictable, is turned into the world, by the generation of adaptive behaviors and modes of representation. It is the process of novelty-driven exploration that, in the individual case, produces such behaviors and strategies of classification. However, we are not only individuals. We exist in a very complex social environment, characterized by the constant exchange of information regarding the means and ends of proper adaptation. The human capacity for the generation of self-regulatory behavior and representation has been expanded immensely, in some ways beyond our own comprehension, by our capacity for verbal and nonverbal communication. We can learn through discussion and by reading, can absorb information directly, even from our departed but literate ancestors. But there is more. We can learn from everyone who acts in the natural course of things, or dramatically, and we can store the behaviors of individuals we come into contact with, directly by copying them, or indirectly through the intermediation of narrative and dramatic art forms. It is, of course, our ability to copy, to mimic, that underlies our capacity to do things we do not necessarily understand, that is, cannot describe explicitly. It is for that reason, in part, that we need a psychology. Patterns of behavioral and representational adaptation are generated in the course of active exploration and contact with the unknown. These patterns do not necessarily remain stable, however, once generated. They are modified and shaped, improved and made efficient as a consequence of their communicative exchange. Individual A produces a new behavior. B modifies it. C modifies that. D radically changes C's modification, and so on ad infinitum. The same process applies to representations, metaphors, say, or explicit concepts. This means that our exploratory, assimilative, and accommodative processes actually extend over vast periods of time and space. Some of this extension, perhaps the most obvious part, is mediated by literacy. An equally complex and subtle element, however, is mediated by mimesis. Patterns of behavioral adaptation and schemas of classification or representation can be derived from the observation of others, and for that matter, from the observation of oneself. How we act in the presence of things in their constantly shifting and generally social context is what those things mean, or even what they are, before what they mean or what they are can be more abstractly or objectively categorized. What a thing is, therefore, might be determined, in the absence of more useful information, by examination of how action is conducted in its presence, which is to say that if someone runs from something, it is safe to presume that the thing is dangerous. The action, in fact, defines that presumption. the observation of action patterns undertaken by the members of any given social community, including those of the observing subject, therefore necessarily allows for the derivation and classification of provisional value schema. If you watch someone, even yourself, approach something, then you can assume that the approached thing is good, at least in some determinate context, even if you don't know anything else about it. Knowing what to do, after all, is classification, before it is abstracted. Classification in terms of motivational relevance, with the sensory aspects of the phenomena serving merely as a cue to recognition of that motivational relevance. It is certainly the case that many of our skills and our automatized strategies of classification are opaque to explicit consciousness. The fact of our multiple memory systems and their qualitatively different modes of representation, described later, ensures that such is the case. This opaqueness means, essentially, that we understand more than we know. It is for this reason that psychologists continue to depend on notions of the unconscious to provide explanations for behavior. This unconsciousness, the psychoanalytic god, is our capacity for the implicit storage of information about the nature and valence of things. This information is generated in the course of active exploration and modified, often unrecognizably, by constant multi-generational interpersonal communication. We live in social groups. Most of our interactions are social in nature. We spend most of our time around others, and when we are alone, we still wish to understand, predict, and control our personal behaviors. Our maps of the understood part of the world are therefore, in large part, maps of patterns of actions, of behaviors established as a consequence of creative exploration and modified in the course of endless social interactions. We watch ourselves act. From this action, we draw inferences about the nature of the world, including those acts that are part of the world. We know that the right hemisphere, at least its frontal portion, is specialized for response to punishment and threat. We also know that damage to the right hemisphere impairs our ability to detect patterns and to understand the meaning of stories. Is it too much to suggest that the emotional, imagistic, and narrative capabilities of the right hemisphere play a key role in the initial stages of transforming something novel and complex, such as the behavior of others, or ourselves, and the valence of new things, into something thoroughly understood? When we encounter something new, after all, we generate fantasies, imagistic, verbal, about its potential nature. This means we attempt to determine how the unexpected thing might relate to something we have already mastered, or at least to other things that we have not yet mastered. To say, this unsolved problem appears to be like this other problem we haven't yet solved, is a step on the way to solution. To say, here is how these still essentially mysterious phenomena appear to hang together, is an intuition of the sort that precedes detailed knowledge, is the capacity to see the forest, though not yet differentiating between the types of trees. Before we truly master something novel, which means before we can effectively limit its indeterminate significance to something predictable, even irrelevant, we imagine what it might be. Our imaginative representations actually constitute our initial adaptations. Our fantasies comprise part of the structure that we use to inhibit our responses to the a priori significance of the unknown, even as such fantasies facilitate generation of more detailed and concrete information. There is no reason to presuppose that we have been able to explicitly comprehend this capacity, in part because it actually seems to serve as a necessary or axiomatic precondition for the ability to comprehend explicitly. The uniquely specialized capacities of the right hemisphere appear to allow it to derive from repeated observations of behavior images of action patterns that the verbal left can arrange with increasing logic and detail into stories. A story is a map of meaning, a strategy for emotional regulation and behavioral output, a description of how to act in a circumstance to ensure that the circumstance retains its positive motivational salience, or at least has its negative qualities reduced to the greatest possible degree. The story appears generated in its initial stages by the capacity for imagery and pattern recognition characteristic of the right hemisphere, which is integrally involved in narrative cognition and in processes that aid or are analogous to such cognition. The right hemisphere has the ability to decode the nonverbal and melodic aspects of speech, to empathize or to engage more generally in interpersonal relationships, and the capacity to comprehend imagery, metaphor, and analogy. The left hemisphere linguistic systems finish the story, adding logic, proper temporal order, internal consistency, verbal representation, and possibility for rapid, abstract, explicit communication. In this way, our explicit knowledge of value is expanded through the analysis of our own dreams. Interpretations that work, that is, that improve our capacity to regulate our own emotions, to turn the current world into the desired world, to say it differently, qualify as valid. It is in this manner that we verify the accuracy of our increasingly abstracted presumptions. The process of creative exploration, the function of the knower, so to speak, who generates explored territory, has as its apparent purpose an increase in the breadth of motoric repertoire, skill, and alteration of representational schema. Each of these two purposes appears served by the construction of a specific form of knowledge and its subsequent storage in permanent memory. The first form has been described as knowing how. The motor unit, charged with origination of new behavioral strategies when old strategies fail, when they produce undesired results, produces alternate action patterns experimentally applied to bring about the desired result. Permanent instantiation of the new behavior, undertaken if the behavior is successful, might be considered development of new skill. Knowing how is skill. The second type of knowing, which is representational, an image or model of something rather than the thing itself, has been described as knowing that. I prefer knowing what. Exploration of a novel circumstance, event, or thing produces new sensory and affective input during active or abstracted interaction of the exploring subject and the object in question. This new sensory input constitutes grounds for the construction, elaboration, and update of a permanent but modifiable four-dimensional, spatial and temporal, representational model of the experiential field in its present and potential future manifestations. This model, I would propose, is a story. It is the hippocampal system, which, as we have seen, is an integral part of the regulation of anxiety, that is critically involved in the transfer of information from observation of ongoing activity to permanent memory, and that provides the physiological basis, in concert with the higher cortical structures, for the development and elaboration of this nestic representation. It is the right hemisphere, which is activated by the unknown, and which can generate patterns rapidly, that provides the initial imagery, the contents of fantasy, for the story. It is the left hemisphere that gives these patterns structure and communicability, as it does, for example, when it interprets a painting, a novel, a drama, or a conversation. The hippocampus notes mismatch. This disinhibits the amygdala, perhaps not directly. Such disinhibition releases anxiety and curiosity, driving exploration. The right hemisphere, under these conditions of motivation, derives patterns relevant to encapsulation of the emergent unknown from the information at its disposal. Much of this information can be extracted from the social environment and the behavioral interactions and strategies of representation, emergent properties of exploration and communication, that are embedded in the social structure. Much of this information is still implicit, that is, coded in behavioral pattern. It is still knowing how before it has been abstracted and made explicit as knowing what. The left hemisphere gets increasingly involved as translation up the hierarchy of abstraction occurs. Knowing how information, described alternatively as procedural, habitual, dispositional, or skilled, and knowing what information, described alternatively as declarative, episodic, factual, autobiographical, or representational, appear physiologically distinct in their material basis and separable in course of phylo and ontogenetic development. Procedural knowledge develops long before declarative knowledge in evolution and individual development and appears represented in unconscious form, expressible purely in performance. Declarative knowledge, by contrast, knowledge of what, simultaneously constitutes consciously accessible and communicable episodic imagination, the world in fantasy, and subsumes even more recently developed semantic, linguistically mediated knowledge, whose operations in large part allow for abstract representation and communication of the contents of the imagination. Squire and Zola Morgan have represented the relationship between these memory forms according to the schematic of Figure 12, the multiple structure of memory. The neuroanatomical basis of knowing how remains relatively unspecified. Skill generation appears in part as the domain of the cortical premotor unit. Storage appears to involve the cerebellum. Knowing what, by contrast, appears dependent for its existence on the intact function of the cortical sensory unit in interplay with the hippocampal system. Much of our knowing what, however, our description of the world, is about knowing how, which is behavioral knowledge, wisdom. Much of our descriptive knowledge, representational knowledge, is representation of what constitutes wisdom, without being that wisdom itself. We have gained our description of wisdom by watching how we act in our culturally governed social interactions and by representing those actions. We know how, which means how to act to transform the mysterious and ever-threatening world of the present into what we desire, long before we know how, or why we know how. This is to say, for example, that a child learns to act appropriately, assuming it does, long before it can provide abstracted explanations for or descriptions of its behavior. A child can be good without being a moral philosopher. This idea echoes the developmental psychologist Jean Piaget's notion with regard to child development that adaptation at the sensory motor level occurs prior to and lays the groundwork for the more abstracted forms of adaptation that characterize adulthood. Piaget regarded imagistic representation as an intermediary between sensory motor intelligence and the highest or most abstract stage of formal operations. Furthermore, he believed that imitation, the acting out of an object, served as a necessary prerequisite to such imagistic representation, portrayal in image or word, instead of behavior. The process of play appears as a higher order or more abstract form of imitation from this perspective. Piaget presents two main theses. The first is that in the field of play and imitation, it is possible to trace the transition from sensory motor assimilation and accommodation to the mental assimilation and accommodation which characterize the beginnings of representation. The second is that the various forms of representation interact. There is representation when an absent model is imitated. There is representation in symbolic play, in imagination, and even in dreams. The systems of concepts and logical relations, both in their intuitive and operational forms, implies representation. Piaget believed that imitation could be described in terms of accommodation. Quote, "If there is primacy of accommodation, matching of behavior, over assimilation, altering of schemas, the activity tends to become imitation." End quote. This implies that the imitating child in fact embodies more information than he understands, represents. Piaget continues, "Representation can be seen to be a kind of interiorized imitation and therefore a continuation of accommodation." With regard to the three-memory system model, which Piaget is of course not directly referring to, open quote, "Even if there were justification for relating the various stages of mental development to well-defined neurological levels, the fact remains that, in spite of the relative discontinuity of the structures, there is a certain functional continuity, each structure preparing for its successors while utilizing its predecessors." End quote. What can be said of children appears true, more or less, phylogenetically. Our cultures, which we absorb as children through the processes of imitation, consist primarily of patterns of activity undertaken in a social context. As parents are to children, cultures are to adults. We do not know how the patterns we act out or the concepts we utilize originated, or what precise purposes, what long-term goals they currently serve. Such patterns are, in fact, emergent properties of long-term social interactions. Furthermore, we cannot describe such patterns well, abstractly, explicitly, semantically, even though we duplicate them accurately and unconsciously in our behavior, and can represent them episodically in our literary endeavors. We do not know why we do what we do, or, to say the same thing, what it is that we are. All ideological theories to the contrary. We watch ourselves and wonder. Our wonder takes the shape of the story, or, more fundamentally, the myth. Myths describing the known, explored territory, constitute what we know about our knowing how before we can state explicitly what it is that we know how. Myth is, in part, the image of our adaptive action as formulated by imagination before its explicit containment in abstract language. Myth is the intermediary between action and abstract linguistic representation of that action. Myth is the distilled essence of the stories we tell ourselves about the patterns of our own behavior as they play themselves out in the social and impersonal worlds of experience. We learn the story, which we do not understand, which is to say, cannot make explicit, by watching. We represent the action patterns we encounter in action, that is ritual, image and word. We act, then represent our behavior ever more abstractly, ever more explicitly, consciously. The central features of our socially determined behavior thus become key elements, characters in our stories. The generation and constant refinement of these stories, told and retold over centuries, allows us to determine ever more clearly just what proper and improper behavior consists of in an environment permanently characterized by the interplay between security and unpredictability. We are extremely, uncontrollably imitative, overwhelmingly social, and interminably exploratory. These characteristics allow us to generate and communicate represented images and, simultaneously, serve as the focal point of inquiry for those images. Our capacity for creative action frees us constantly from the ever-shifting demands of the environment. The ability to represent creative action, to duplicate observed creativity in our own actions, and to represent that creativity in detail and essence allows everyone to benefit from the creative action of everyone else, at least everyone with whom communication might conceivably take place. The fact of our sociability ensures that our adaptive behaviors are structured with the social community in mind, at least in the long run, and increases our chances of exposure to creative intelligence. We observe others acting in a manner we find admirable and duplicate their actions. In this manner, we obtain the skills of others. Our capacity for abstraction allows us to take our facility for imitation one step further, however. We can learn to imitate not only the precise behaviors that constitute adaptation, but the process by which those behaviors were generated. This means we can learn not only skill, but meta-skill, can learn to mimic the pattern of behavior that generates new skills. It is the encapsulation of meta-skill in a story that makes that story great. Our imitative proclivity, expressed in behavior, appears to find its more abstracted counterpart in the ability to admire, which is a permanent, innate, or easily acquired constituent element of our intrapsychic state. This capability for awe, this desire to copy, often serves to impel further psychological and cognitive development. The worshipful attitude that small boys adopt toward their heroes, for example, constitutes the outward expression of the force that propels them toward embodying or incarnating or even inventing oft ill-defined heroic qualities themselves. The capacity for imitation surfaces in more abstract guise in the human tendency to act as if, to identify with another, to become another in fantasy, which means to ritually identify with or unconsciously adopt the story of another. This means the ability to adopt someone else's goal as if it were yours. The capacity to act as if expresses itself in admiration, ranging in intensity from the simple respect accorded a competent other to abject worship, and, even more abstractly, in ideological possession. No independent instinct necessarily needs to be postulated to account for this mimetic ability, although one may well exist. All that may be necessary is the capacity to observe that another has obtained a goal that is also valued by the observer. That observation provides the necessary motivation and the skill to duplicate the procedures observed to lead to such fulfillment. Mimetic propensity, expressed in imitative action, provides for tremendous expansion of behavioral competence, allows the ability of each to become the capability of all. Precise duplicative facility, however, still retains pronounced limitations. Specific behaviors retain their adaptive significance only within particular restricted environments, only within bounded frames of reference. If environmental contingencies shift, for whatever reason, the utility of strategies designed for the original circumstance and transmitted through imitation may become dramatically restricted or even reversed. The capacity for abstraction of imitation, which is, in the initial stages, capability for dramatic play, overcomes the specific restrictions of exact imitation, elaborating reproduction of particular acts, removing the behavior to be copied from its initial specific context, establishing its first-level declarative representation and generalization. Play allows for the permanent extension of competence and confidence through pretense, which means through metaphoric and symbolic action, which is semantic use of episodic representation, and for natural expansion of behavioral range from safe, predictable, self-defined contexts out toward the unknown world of experience. Play creates a world in rule-governed fantasy, in episodic or imagistic representation, in which behavior can be rehearsed and mastered prior to its expression in the real world with real-world consequences. Play is another form of as-if behavior that allows for experimentation with fictional narrative, pretended descriptions of the current and desired future states of the world, with plans of action appended designed to change the former into the latter. To play means to set, or to fictionally transform, fictional goals. Such fictional goals give valence to phenomena that would, in other contexts, remain meaningless, valence that is informative without being serious. Play allows us to experiment with means and ends themselves without subjecting ourselves to the actual consequences of real behavior and to benefit emotionally in the process. The goals of play are not real. The incentive rewards, however, that accompany movement to a pretended goal, these are real, although bounded, like game-induced anxieties. The bounded reality of such affect accounts, at least in part, for the intrinsic interest that motivates and accompanies play, or immersion in any dramatic activity. Play transcends imitation in that it is less context-bound. It allows for the abstraction of essential principles from specific, admirable instances of behavior. Play allows for the initial establishment of a more general model of what constitutes allowable or ideal behavior. Elaboration of dramatic play into formal drama likewise ritualizes play, abstracting its key elements one level more and further distills the vitally interesting aspects of behavior, which are representative, by no mere chance, of that active exploratory and communicative pattern upon which all adaptation is necessarily predicated. Theatrical ritual dramatically represents the individual and social consequences of stylized, distilled behavioral patterns based in their expression upon different assumptions of value and expectations of outcome. Formal drama clothes potent ideas in personality, exploring different paths of directed or motivated action, playing out conflict cathartically, offering ritual models for emulation or rejection. Dramatic personae embody the behavioral wisdom of history. In an analogous fashion, in a less abstract, less ritualized manner, the ongoing behavior of parents dramatizes cumulative mimetic history for children. Emergence of narrative, which contains much more information than it explicitly presents, further disembodies the knowledge extant latently in behavioral pattern. Narrative presents semantic representation of play or drama, offers essentially abstracted episodic representations of social interaction and individual endeavor, and allows behavioral patterns contained entirely in linguistic representation to incarnate themselves in dramatic form on the private stage of individual imagination. Much of the information derived from a story is actually already contained in episodic memory. In a sense, it could be said that the words of the story merely act as a retrieval cue for information already in the nestic system of the listener, although perhaps not yet transformed into a form capable either of explicit semantic communication or alteration of procedure. It is for this reason that Shakespeare might be viewed as a precursor to Freud. Think of Hamlet. Shakespeare knew what Freud later discovered, but he knew it more implicitly, more imagistically, more procedurally. This is not to say that Shakespeare was any less brilliant, just that his level of abstraction was different. Ideas, after all, come from somewhere. They do not arise spontaneously from the void. Every complex psychological theory has a lengthy period of historical development, development that might not be evidently linked to the final emergence of the theory. Interpretation of the reason for dramatic consequences portrayed in narrative, generally left to the imagination of the audience, constitutes analysis of the moral of the story. Transmission of that moral, That rule for behavior or representation is the purpose of narrative. Just as fascination, involuntary seizure of interest, is its biologically predetermined means. With development of the story, mere description of critically important and therefore compelling behavioral representational patterns becomes able to promote active imitation. At this point, the semantic system, activating images in episodic memory, sets the stage for the alteration of procedure itself. This means establishment of a feedback loop wherein information can cycle up and down levels of consciousness with the social environment as necessary intermediary, transforming itself and expanding as it moves. Development of narrative means verbal abstraction of knowledge disembodied in episodic memory and embodied in behavior. It means capability to disseminate such knowledge widely and rapidly throughout a communicating population with minimal expenditure of time and energy. Finally, it means intact preservation of such knowledge simply and accurately for generations to come. Narrative description of archetypal behavioral patterns and representational schemas, myth, appears as an essential precondition for social construction and subsequent regulation of complexly civilized individual presumption, action, and desire.